Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Whenever you tune into AMC's television series Mad Men, your eye inevitably at some point moves from the very attractive actors to the exquisite period office furniture or the stovetop or appliance that was in your parents' kitchen or the bedroom linens that scream 1960s. Well, that look, which is so much a part of Mad Men's success, is the work of the set decorator. My guest today was the set decorator for the first three seasons of Mad Men and set the tone for the environment of the men and women of the Sterling Cooper ad agency. Amy Wells is a veteran set decorator with 12 films and 7 television series to her credit. She has just finished the final season of House and has also worked on films like Last of the Mohicans, Clueless, American Pie, There Will Be Blood, as well as fashion icon Tom Ford's debut film, A Single Man. Amy Wells joins us today to share the fashion sense surrounding a series like Mad Men. I spoke with her earlier this year. Amy Wells, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
First of all, let's just start. What does a set decorator do on a television series or a film?
A set decorator is responsible for the furnishings and objects and art on the walls or whatever the set requires to make it the environment for the actors.
Now, how does that differ from a set designer? The designer creates the design and then you implement it, basically?
Well, actually, there's a lot of terminology in film and TV, and it's all very confusing, even to the people that are in it. So we actually had to write little guides of who does what because it's so confusing. But the head of the art department is called the production designer, and the production designer is responsible for the overall look of a production. So he kind of oversees everyone. He or she would oversee the set decorator, the art director, the property master, and would confab with the costume designer as well, and as well work with the producer and director in helping choose the locations and in working out what the set actually needs to look like to serve the script. Once that happens, then there's an art director who basically is the communicator, the communication arm of the production designer. So they would work with construction and paint and make sure that the ideas of the production designer are carried out and that everyone has plans and all the plans are being carried out. And then from there, I come in. I have to go back a second. So then from there is a set designer. And what a set designer does is they're a draftsperson, and they draft the production designer's ideas and put the ideas into a blueprint, which is then distributed amongst the different departments.
So everybody's working from the same idea. Basically.
Everyone's working from the same idea.
And then the set decorator comes in.
And then the set decorator comes in, and often we put together an idea board, either with the production designer or on our own, to show what we're thinking about, what the set's going to look like. And often the designer is the one that picks the colors, but oftentimes, you know, because of budgetary reasons, if let's say we're doing a living room set and it's a grand room, and we want to, you know, create a certain environment, and the only thing that's available is a light green couch, and we don't want to recover the couch, then we would tell the designer, look, you know, this is the color that's available. There's a pair of couches. They're the best ones in town. We need to use them. So if we can use these green ones, that would be great. And then the whole set gets built around that. Because it's, I have worked on a lot of period shows that sometimes, not all the time, dictates the color or the look.
Well, let's talk about your time on Mad Men, because everybody talks about the look of the show, and it's so important to the show's success, I think. This is like early 60s. The first thing I noticed is, you know, we're so used to black and white photos and film at that particular time. The colors come as a, you know, I know there was color photography in magazines and fashion magazines, but, you know, most of the coverage of that period was still in black and white. So you don't get the sense of all this vibrant color that was a part of that era.
Right. Yeah. Well, there was color, and it wasn't quite as vibrant as it is now, and or as it was later in the 60s. The earlier 60s were not, they didn't have the real poppy hot colors that the later 60s had. All the research that we had was mostly in color. I mean, there was some black and white. So, first of all, I lived during that time. And so I had a pretty good idea in my sense memory of what those colors were. And also spent so much time just absorbing research in the years that I've been doing this, not just on Mad Men, but years ago I did something called From the Earth to the Moon, which took
Same
place during
period,
the
yeah.
Apollo years. And when I was an assistant set decorator, I did something called Love Field, which was, took place in the week that Kennedy was shot. So I was pretty steeped in that period already, and had a lot of information in my brain about what it looked like.
Of course, Mad Men, you have New York Madison Avenue offices, which are going to be the very toniest design of that period. You have homes, you have hotels, you have
We had a lot of
bars,
hotels, yeah.
bars and restaurants. This sounds like a huge job.
Huge job, but an interesting job
Right.
for certain. I mean, certainly the best decorating job on television, I would say. I felt incredibly fortunate to be a part of it. What I also enjoy is that there's different levels of socioeconomic levels of each character, like Peggy's apartment versus Pete's apartment versus,
The suburb home, yeah.
suburban homes and New York apartments and Brooklyn apartments. And I was just looking at Peggy's sister's home the other day, and I had put a plastic covered sofa in there, and it was sort of that 50s hard rock maple look, and I spent a lot of time looking for those things.
So, first of all, we think of television and film having enormous budgets to be able to go out, and if you can't find the piece, you go out and make it. And I, from what I understand, set decorators, you're hitting, garage sales, you're hitting the various warehouses where furniture's kept. And this has become very collectible. The original stuff has become very collectible.
And even more so now than when I started, and certainly, when I did Love Field in Richmond, Virginia, back in, the late 80s, I just remember walking into the Salvation Army and finding stuff that had
You found your set.
I would like find, gliders for like $20 that were like beautiful old metal porch gliders, and just 60s stuff everywhere. It was just amazing. And then as the years went on, it became more and more difficult to find. But nonetheless, I searched high and low. I mean, the great part about it was that it was a complete and utter scavenger hunt every week. It was just constant searching. And there were times when I would see something that I knew was fantastic, and I would buy it because if it was priced right, I knew that I was going to use it on that show by hell or high water. I was going to get that on the show because it was affordable. I think I paid like $90 for Pete's dining room set. It was like in the back basement area of some, old, antique mall, and it was kind of in the discarded area, and so things like that. And I didn't know exactly I was going to use it for Pete's, but then when I got in there, I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad I bought that dining room set, because you kind of have to grab it when you see it and it's the right price.
Yeah, and I would think a lot of this stuff is very collectible. A lot of this stuff has been used and beat up to the point where you don't want to put it on
Well,
television.
when it came to like all the executive desks in Sterling Cooper, I mean, I found those, a lot of those were original Knoll desks, and we had our paint department refinish them. Or, oftentimes because they were so well made and because the wood was real walnut, that I would take this stuff called Restora Finish. I swear I could do like a really great ad for this stuff because I'm holding it up now. I'm like, I love that stuff. And I would rub it on the desk and be like, it's like new. I remember I walked into the producer's office, Dwayne Shattuck's office, and he had a desk that I had put in there. And, you know, it kind of looked like that dried old walnut, you know, like it had seen many days gone by. And I said, let me just polish up your desk. I'll be right back. And I took the Restore Finish and I put it all over the desk. And he was like, I cannot believe it. It's fantastic. And so, you know, that stuff really spiffs up pretty well. Mm-hmm. Anything that's made well kind of comes back a lot easier than if it's not.
Of course, you know, the 50s and 60s was the era of plastics, you know, and we did a show at Philbrook a couple of years ago for a Hans Hoffman exhibit where we actually sort of looked at all the trends of the 50s. One of the things I was doing was sort of social trends, and I had the Scientific American article from like 1950 looking at the year 2000, and you know, no sustainability, no green, everything will be plastic, we'll have dishes that you'll use one time and throw away. And that's the mindset that's starting at least at the beginning of the series in the early 60s. It was plastics. Disposable furniture. And if you're going to be true to that era and use some of that stuff, I would think that would be very difficult to find.
Actually, it wasn't. Because I think they made even plastic better back then, I swear. It's like, then I would do this and I became obsessed with something called dead stock. Do you know what dead stock is?
No.
Okay, so dead stock is something that is in its original packaging. It's in its original form. It would be a piece of clothing with the tag still on it that had never been used, but it's from 1959. Or, you know, there were a lot of, you know, sets of those plastic tumblers and little, you know, there were luncheon sets and all sorts of things.
And there's
things.
Packaging involved.
They're still
with all
in
of
the
it.
Package yeah. because the people never used them and they passed away. It went to a Salvation Army or whatever, got picked up by an antique dealer, and there it is in its package. And I would get such a thrill of seeing things in their original packaging. It's still.
And that's something the show does. It's a lot of little touches like that. You know, magazines that sort of give you a sense of place. And, you know, you think of a 50-year-old Life magazine that looks pristine, like it just came out
right,
this week.
Right, but what we did with magazines a lot. Uh-huh. Is that we would take the original and then tweak it, yeah, and make it and clean it up graphically so that it was actually a new version of the old one. Because paper goods, more than anything, turn brown.
Right.
And they crumble.
So what's most difficult about getting for the set for this period? Is it? I think I read an interview said hotel rooms are –
Well, what happened with hotel rooms, of course, is that I used every last stick of furniture that looked like it would be appropriate for a hotel in the first two seasons. It was just like, really, we're having another hotel room? Can't they like meet somewhere else, like in the back room of a bar, which actually she did. But, you know, it's just because hotels have a certain ambiance and feeling, you know, about them. It's about how the furniture matches. It's not residential. It's not exactly a residential bedroom. So that was very difficult. And also bedspreads, just finding those quilted bedspreads that they had back then. I mean,
all sorts of linens, I would think.
Yeah, no, and linens is one thing I would find dead stock and just, you know, swoon over. You know, love those old sheets and things. But no, the linens, and of course in hotels, they were mostly white back then. They didn't have all the fancy, you know, they were crisp, white, good, you know, 100% cotton sheets back then. But, you know, it was the bedspread itself and the feeling of that it was in a hotel. And, you know, if you'd have two beds in the hotel room, you'd have to find two period matching bedspreads. And if I didn't find them, I'd have to make them. But, you know, there was a certain quality about everything that if you touched a real one and saw how it just laid over the bed so easily, it didn't have, you know, Dacron. It probably had cotton batting, so it just fell really nicely on the bed. And so all of that stuff, you know, just became more and more challenging as we went along, is to find, you know, not repeat furniture, to find new furniture. So we were really hunting under every rock we could, you know, spreading out further and further on the internet and on Craigslist and everything else to find, you know, that sort of furniture.
Beyond furniture, what's most difficult to find?
Art.
Art.
because you cannot just go anywhere. I can find a piece of period art anywhere. I mean, I would find great paintings every day of the week. But what you can't do is you can't take it and put it on the wall because someone will sue you. And trust me, they will sue you.
Right.
So there's
there was such a big thing about the Beatles song here just a few weeks ago.
Oh, really? I didn't hear about that.
They had their first Beatles song, and I think they paid $250,000 for it to actually, and it was, you know, one of the obscure tunes from Revolver.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, music clearance, and you know.
And art clutter, and the copyright.
Right. I mean, when we used, do you remember when the Rothko painting was used in Cooper's office when he bought the Rothko and he put it up on the wall and they're all looking at it? And I think, you know, I don't remember how much we'd paid for that clearance, but it, you know, was on my budget. And it was, you know, it wasn't $250,000 or anywhere near that, but still a lot more than I could afford in my budget to pay. And we had it reproduced. We didn't have an original Rothko. And then we had to have it destroyed after the shooting was done because there can't be some fake Rothko floating around. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not fair to the estate. I mean, I really value artists and their work. So, you know, I want them to be protected. But sometimes you find some obscure thing and you want to use it and you can't find the artist. And, you know, it really limited me. And I think, you know, all of us decorators feel quite limited by the clearance issues. It used to be, you know, if you watch the Lucy show, I'm sure there's nothing on those walls that was cleared, even, you know, probably 20 years after that, you know, or, you know, Hawaii 5-0, I'm sure they probably weren't clearing things. But as the country became more and more aware of copyrights and things like that, it became more and more difficult.
So if you're going to use a piece of art, even if it's like your ubiquitous hotel painting, you know, do you have to try to track down the artist if you're going to use it?
Well, there are prop houses that have period art, but the period art is limited. And believe me, I went through that art and it was very frustrating and I'm sure continues to be so. You know, I wanted to create it. I started like thinking about calling, you know, artists that, you know, a lot of my friends had parents that were artists and painters that I grew up with. And, you know, I started looking at their early work. But, of course, I was a little nervous about taking really good original art and putting it on the set. I would rather make what's called a giclée and put it on the set.
Right. A copy, yeah. My guest today is Amy Wells, the set decorator for the first three seasons of AMC's series Mad Men. Just finished her second season of House. Just finished a film with Paul Thomas Anderson. Right. And as I count, you've been set decorator for 12 films and assistant decorator on a number of others and sort of unit decoration on other films, seven TV series. This is a lot of work over the years.
I've never really counted, but something like that, yeah.
And earlier you were talking about how sort of the 60s is sort of your period that you tend to work with. I was looking at there's a From the Earth to the Moon, which was a miniseries from HBO. Of course, Mad Men, A Single Man, early 60s.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the new film is also set in the 60s. Can you get typecast as a set decorator of a particular era, or are you just more period? People think of you when they think of a period.
I guess you probably, you know, one could get typecast, but I sort of bounce back and forth a lot, so I've been fortunate in that way. I mean, certainly House takes place now, so. But yes, I think that there are some of us whose strong suit is period work, and we know how to do the research and find the stuff and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So I'm probably typecast. Yeah, you're really right, Rich.
How closely do you work with, like, the overall director? Or is the art department sort of their own area?
You know, it depends. It goes from show to show how much exposure a decorator would work with a director. And TV and film are completely different. I mean, completely different. On a film, you would mainly work with the director. You wouldn't even talk to the producer about the look of the show. Mm-hmm. But in a show like Mad Men, it's a producer-driven medium. So in that sense, the producer would be the one to, you know, say, you know, communicate what they want the show to be and look like. They're sort of the creative overall creative driving force.
A lot of TV series are working on a 7-day schedule.
That's how Mad Men was when we first started. Now it's 8 days. Uh-huh. But wow, that's like enough to kill somebody, I'll tell you right now. That was like you don't even have a chance to breathe in that on that sort of schedule.
So at the first day of that schedule, you're getting your requirements, or are you working several weeks ahead, or what exactly?
Well, you get the script like the week before, and you start on your concept meeting. But remember, simultaneously to doing that script, you're also shooting and dressing the other script. So I'd be like stuck in a meeting, you know, talking about the script that's upcoming and having people running around everywhere looking for stuff that needed to be found for the script that was shooting. So the sets that we're shooting at that moment. So that's the nerve-wracking part, is being in a meeting and there are God knows how many hours of meetings a week, and really having to be doing your job at the same time. And I really like to see and touch things before they get on the set. That's sort of the way I have to do it. I can't just look at a picture. I like to see something with my own eyes, because a picture never shows you the scale or the texture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it never gives you the true color.
Mm. And so you have to really see the object to see, okay, is this going to fit in with what I'm doing?
Right.
And certainly in an office, everything has to be absolutely integrated, because you figure that's the way most offices are created, especially high Tony offices like on Madison Avenue.
Right.
Homes, I guess you can have a mix and match sort of look a little more.
Yeah, depending on what the home is and uh-huh. how streamlined the look is. But, you know, like with Sterling Cooper, imagine having to find like the right desk pads. They don't even exist.
Yeah.
What about all the staplers? What about matching typewriters?
Typewriters. When I was thinking of your job, I said I would think office equipment would probably be one of the most, because it gets used up, beat up, and then thrown away, and nobody keeps.
Right.
I'm sure there are a few guys that have IBM Selectric somewhere.
Yeah, and we did find them, and then I'd see them and buy them and whatever, but, you know, they'd have to be the earlier Selectrics. And, of course, you know, we got a lot of flack for using the Selectric, and the reason why we picked it was because it made less noise.
Mm-hmm.
We started in 1962, and the Selectrics weren't out quite yet. But that was a little bit of fudging that we did. So I always, in my own brain, to make it okay, thought, well, they were the ad agency for IBM. And so that was the prototype, and they were given to the ad agency to use before anybody else got them on the market.
Right. Now, you worked the first 3 seasons, but I would think that as this series progressed, because it is progressing in time, you're going to see a total... You know, you're going to see a changeover in look, and you've already started to see that changeover in look in the series mm-hmm. now that you're no longer on that show. I think that would be really difficult, too. You know, usually most television shows, they would have a look, and that's sort of the look, especially in a sort of that sort of weird TV time.
But I think that that's what makes Mad Men great, mm-hmm. is that, you know, it does constantly evolve. It doesn't stay the same. You know, there's always something going on with the look or the people, or, you know, I think that's what keeps it exciting. You know?
My guest today is Amy Wells, the set decorator for the first 3 seasons of AMC's series Mad Men. Just finished up her second season of House. Now you're going back to House. House is finishing.
House is finished
forever.
Right.
Yeah, those are the series finale this year. Now, you've done a lot of work in mid-century. Some of your earliest work was like in the 19th century, The Last of the Mohicans. I think that was one of your first set decorators.
Yeah, 18th century on that.
18th century, excuse me. Stargate, science fiction. There Will Be Blood, Sex in the City, which that's high fashion, contemporary. What's the hardest era to find good objects for films? Is it period pieces?
Yeah, I mean, if you're... You know, the good thing about the 18th century is there wasn't that much stuff. I love the 18th century.
You could give a carpenter, say.
You put a Betty lamp out there and a couple of, you know, wood chairs, and you're good to go. Now,
take a couple of logs, make a table out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the 18th century thing, the simplicity of that is fantastic. I love it. all periods at all time, even present day, have their own challenges. I mean, present day is hard because you can never decide, you know, are we going for the Pottery Barn look? Then everybody reads L.J. Cor now, so they, you know, there isn't a producer or director that doesn't think they're a decorator, you know, which, you know, is sometimes a little, you know, problematic.
What about science fiction? I mean, you're having to imagine a future or a past that was never.
Yeah, I mean, for most of that, I mean, that would be something that those objects and those pieces in it are mostly created.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think there's always going to be some objects that you have to.
Yeah, that you have to.
And you go, what would they still use from now?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot that goes on in our heads. A lot of, you know, I think of like in a day, how many choices and decisions I have to make for like thousands of objects that I have to choose. And it's just sometimes it almost hurts inside my head. It's like, no, I don't want to have to make another decision.
Now, in a film, you have this director who has this vision. And so it's always about meeting up with that vision, too.
Right.
That's a difficult job.
Yeah, it can be a difficult job. I mean, certainly, I mean, you know, working with a designer like Tom Ford, who's a designer himself, you know, and an artist in his own right, you know, that was, you know, very tricky to, you know, it was a constant editing process with Tom Ford because he just has incredibly heightened, amazing sense of design. And he had very specific ideas about what he wanted. And so it was fulfilling that for him. Fulfilling the wishes of another artist is a difficult task.
Oh. That was from the film A Single Man.
Yes, which I'm very proud of.
Set in the early 60s.
Yeah.
It had this, at times, almost a scrubbed look to it. I mean,
and he wanted that. I mean, because it was George's last day on the planet. Yeah. He wanted it to have a heightened sense of it wasn't, he didn't want authenticity and reality in that sense. He wanted the reality of George to see the world through George's eyes. So that, you know, that's what I have to do is understand what Tom is saying so that he can get what he wants for his movie.
All right. Well, Amy Wells, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Set decorator Amy Wells speaking with us back in May here on Studio Tulsa when she was a guest of Philbrook Museum for their Third Thursday program. By the way, tomorrow on Studio Tulsa, we'll be featuring this month's Third Thursday guest, architect Teddy Cruz. That's tomorrow on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Public Radio Tulsa, with support from the Canebrake, present our second annual Swing on This broadcast and dance featuring the Tulsa Playboys with special guest Cowbop, live at the Canes Ballroom Saturday evening, October 13th at 7 o'clock. Join us as host John Woolley celebrates the 100th birthday of Tulsa's own Western Swing legend, Johnny Lee Wills, and a great evening of Tulsa's heritage music. Reserve seats available at $40 and proceeds benefit Public Radio Tulsa. Information at publicradiotulsa.org.